Welcome to the Land and Everything Else podcast. This is Dr. Craig Lemoyne along with Ailey Elmore. Please join us as we learn about investing from dirt to derivatives. The Land and Everything Else podcast is brought to you by the College of Agriculture, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences and the Department of Agriculture and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We are thrilled to have you with us today and hope you learn more about alternative investments. Well, Ilian, thank you so much for coming out today. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate Vivaldi and you sitting down with us on the Land and Everything Else podcast today. We were pre-gaming some great conversations, so we'll weave them into today's flow.
Absolutely.
But I was wondering if you could introduce yourself a little more formally and share what you do and who you are.
Sure. Ilya Zlotnik. I'm an advisor and partner with Vivaldi Capital Management, a registered investment advisor that's only a few blocks from here in downtown Chicago, but we do have offices across the country. I've been with the firm since 2014 when we were in the suburbs.
Okay.
And it was six of us managing about $150 million. Fast forward to today, we're about $4 billion in assets and 20 advisors or so across the country. What makes us unique is that although at this point, you know, clients do come to us for comprehensive wealth management, helping them with all aspects of their financial lives. But we really built our business within a unique expertise within alternatives. So we built out a research team first, investment research, operational research on real estate, private equity, private credit, and hedge funds, primarily for high net worth, ultra high net worth, and family office type clients.
Well, and I think that's why I was so excited to talk with you guys. Mm-hmm. Like from a personal anecdote, when I started at U of I, in 2017, Vivaldi was one of the firms we engaged with and hired one of our top students. And I'm excited to get to talk to her later. You work with her.
She's here.
She's here.
Fantastic. She's been on my team for years.
So I was excited. And then, you know, we announced we're doing this podcast and Mackenzie was like, hey, we do alts. Like, we don't just do alts. Like, we really do alts.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So I was excited. And, you know, part of our purview of doing this Land and Everything Else is digging a little more into the non-stock and bond landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my first question, it's a big question and there's no right or wrong answer, but when you sit down with customers and clients, you know, how do you look at that total portfolio and where do you see space for non-stock and bond assets or non-traditional stock and bond assets?
Yeah, great question. So because of the way we built our business with a focus on research in the alternative investment space first, we have the ability to kind of go multiple directions with clients. And there's some clients that come to us and say, you know, they're busy professionals. They might not have expertise within really much as it relates to investing, sure, or personal finance, nor the time.
Right.
So we can help them with everything, right?
Okay.
So we spend the time up front, we gather all their information. And when we have the final product in terms of a proposal for their portfolio, that's typically in line with who they are, what their comfort level is with risk, liquidity, it's going to have a pretty good balance of equities, fixed income, hedge funds in the right accounts for tax efficiency, real estate, and private equity. So it's going to look different than your traditional 60-40.
It really is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And to that end, I guess if you wouldn't mind sharing just a little about your processes, right?
Sure.
I think one of the things that advisors and agents and brokers, I think we struggle with a little bit.
Yeah.
Is that process of, okay, you know, how do I decide what kind of products are going to play well with traditional assets and what kind, mm-hmm, of products am I going to use in that mix? So if,
absolutely,
you could speak a little bit about, you know, you talk about private credit and private equity and hedge funds, like what process do you go through to kind of sort the good, the bad, the ugly, and decide which of those products you're going to wind up using?
Yeah. Mackenzie's probably heard me use the word process a million times.
I love process.
It's all about process.
Have to have it.
Yeah.
That's what a fiduciary is. I've decided at the end of the day, fiduciary is process.
Absolutely.
But that's my, I'll throw that in there.
Absolutely. So the way, if you look at, and I'll compare it to investing in traditional assets.
Please do.
The world's gravitated towards investing oftentimes in ETFs, and personalized indexing has been a big theme recently.
Yes.
And it's all about low cost exposure to global markets or domestic markets and participating in long-term growth and tax efficiency, which is a really important part of a portfolio, but it doesn't really require a lot of research.
Right.
You know, you're going to get exposure to the S&P 500, you go to Schwab, Vanguard, Fidelity, it's going to be the same at the same cost.
Mm-hmm.
Can't mess it up.
No.
Alternatives, you can really mess it up.
Yes.
There's a really good statistic that shows the difference in historical returns between, for example, real estate managers that are historically in the top quartile versus the bottom quartile. So our job is to be able to partner with those folks in the top quartile as much as we can, because the difference between that and bottom quartile managers could be making a lot of money versus not making money and losing money. So it goes back to process. So what does process look like? Process is first sourcing, right? So you want to have a very active funnel of new managers that are coming through our offices, or we're going to see them. Our research team over the years has, you know, we have a 15 plus person research team. We probably see 500 new ideas, both domestically and globally. We're traveling internationally now.
Wow.
To see new managers. And we might approve 5 to 8 of those managers per year, right? So that gives you an idea of what percentage of people that we see versus who gets actually
like
approved.
1 or 2% is getting through.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah. So you have sourcing, having a very active funnel of new ideas coming to us on an ongoing basis. And those ideas can come from clients, reverse inquiry. It can come from speed dating events. You know, literally our research team is sitting there like speed dating different managers.
Okay.
So all different ways to see new managers. Then there's the diligence process. There's investment due diligence. We have two teams, IDD and ODD, investment due diligence and operational due diligence. So it's one thing. And by the way, most of these alternative managers that we invest in, they're not massive organizations like a Vanguard. They're small entrepreneurial organizations that raise $100 million to $1 billion of capital. Mm-hmm. And they're like Navy SEALs, right? They're looking for opportunities to take advantage of that stuff. So we want to make sure that, hey, nobody's going to come to us and say, we haven't had great performance in the past.
Of course.
Everybody has great performance.
Everybody has great performance. It's just a matter of the time period, the averages you're using, how you shake it.
Yeah.
Right.
So our job is to say, okay, can that performance, is that real performance?
Okay.
Is it repeatable? And is it scalable to some extent? So that's their job. There's a 15 plus checklist that we have to make sure, going back to process, that everything that we want to look at gets looked at. That's investment due diligence. And then there's operational due diligence, you know, background checks on all the employees. We want to make sure that every single organization has the right third-party service providers, high quality ones. So accounting, administrative, legal, right? You don't want any of these types of Bernie Madoff situations where you have these organizations that are using their own in-house tax and, you know, documentation folks, you know. We don't mess around with that. And the other thing is that we want to see is, are these people investing in their own funds and how much? Alignment of interest that we talked about offline is so important. If they're not investing a significant amount of their own capital alongside our investors, we're not really interested in investing with them.
Do you work with farming, ranching, or agribusiness clients? Do you want to help farm and ranch families ensure their business success into the next generation? Are you ready to build relationships that will last a lifetime? The Agriculture Focus Financial Planner designation at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign will help you develop the skills you need to better serve the farming, ranching, and agriculture community. This booming market relies on competent and skillful financial professionals to achieve its goals of farm families. The AFFP designation teaches you about crop insurance, legacy planning, social security for farmers, and other topics critical to serving these communities. Find out more information about the AFFP at affp.illinois.edu or search for Agriculture Focused Financial Planner on your favorite browser. Well, and I think that's interesting. As I've explored the regulatory space and alts, and specifically, you know, non-public, non-listed securities, right? I think your look at the accounting and legal practices sort of shores up some concern that we sometimes have in the private space.
That's right.
Which is that you know, here's our financials. Maybe they're not audited. Maybe they're not reviewed. And I think having that process in place really shores up the confidence level there. And I would imagine, you know, as far as looking at good guy, bad guy, I hope that that helps with that journey.
That's the big difference between public and private, right? Public, they already have the SEC doing all that work for you. As an investor, you don't have to worry about it. In the private space, if you're not aligning yourself with a group like Vivaldi, you shouldn't be doing it on your own unless you're an expert, because there's so many different things you can step into that might down the road blow up in your face.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the, as I've written about this area, right? I think that's really the gap, the value add an advisor has is saying like, all right, we understand that this isn't a public offering. This hasn't gone through the same registration with the state and SEC. We're going to come in and review the legal and accounting here and make sure that this is not garbage.
That's right.
Right? Not a Madoff situation you're stepping into.
Yeah.
Well, I really appreciate that. And I guess I wanted to talk just a little bit about, you know, Is there a difference between when you're working with a consumer client, even high net worth, and maybe an institution or retirement plan or something like that? Mm-hmm. Do you look at different allocations in the alt space, or do you stay pretty consistent?
Well, it's going to be different. If you're, we have a 401k division,
sure.
And there's rules, ERISA rules
around the
401k as much as what you could use in terms, and it's predominantly going to be very plain vanilla ETFs, stocks and bonds, like a 60-40 allocation. Sure. When it comes to high net worth, ultra high net worth investors, it's really going to vary. It's going to be client dependent. We have some clients that come to us exclusively for alternatives.
Sure.
They do everything else themselves. They just want an avenue to be able to get access to good ideas. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's 100% alternative, private equity, real estate type portfolios. Other clients say, you know, hey, we love you for everything else you do. You do great comprehensive planning work. I'm not really interested in illiquidity. So it might be a minimal to non-existent part of their portfolio. So it's very much dependent on process.
Entirely.
And understanding the client.
Right. Which processes the entire, you know, that financial planning, wealth management journey helps get us to the right investments.
Yeah. And having conversations like this.
Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
So I wanted to put on our professor hats for a minute.
Okay.
Right? And your professor hat and mine.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit just about private equity. Right. Mm-hmm. From the standpoint, let's demystify it a little bit for our friends that aren't using private equity, aren't working with private equity. When I say private equity, if you're kind of explaining that to a new hire, walk me through that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at the most simplest level, the difference between private and public is one's public and you can go on the New York Stock Exchange into Schwab and Vanguard.
And custodians will trade it. Yeah.
And custodians will. It's very easy to buy. Private equity, they're the same types of businesses, right? There's businesses in the private markets, like SpaceX is an example.
Exactly.
Business that we've
That's a great example.
In. We recently invested at $175 billion valuation. The only difference is it's a private company. So you have to have access to it through different channels or relationships that we have through private equity groups. These ones happen to be in Silicon Valley that were early investors in SpaceX to be able to get access to the shares. The other difference is regulatory requirements and filings. Public markets, there's a ton of transparency around what's going on in the business. Elon Musk doesn't have to tell anybody anything. And he can still raise capital, right? That's a unique circumstance.
But I mean, private equity in general, you're issuing securities or I guess bonds too, right? You can issue credit.
Absolutely.
To that end.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, we talk a little bit about alternatives and liquidity constraint, right? Is that's one of the, whenever you do a pro-con list and you're looking at alts, you say, okay, but you know, you can't necessarily sell them on Tuesday.
Yeah.
So speak to me a little bit about that. Or when you use alts with clients, what conversations do you have around liquidity and the actual products themselves? Where do you see liquidity constraints and where maybe less so?
Yeah. So this is where it comes down to having those conversations and really understanding what clients want. I had a conversation with a client the other day who's looking to join, and we really talked about he's like, I have a certain portion of capital that I want to commit to you. And I said, well, what's the purpose of that capital? It's like, I don't plan on retiring anytime soon.
Okay.
I have great lifestyle, great cash flow. This is all about passing money down to my kids, my grandkids, and probably giving money to different causes. So then he's 60 and he's got 10, 20, 30, 40 years ahead of him. Liquidity isn't an issue. It's about maximizing return.
Sure.
So when you're talking about putting him into a private equity or venture capital fund that has maybe an 8, 10, 12 year illiquidity window, I'm less concerned about that. With clients that might need current income and all that kind of stuff, then you want to be a little bit more sensitive about illiquidity. It's not that it's inappropriate, but you want to look at it as the overall portfolio and what's the most amount you want to put in their portfolio that's illiquid, and how much do you want to complement that with stocks and bonds that they have access to right away.
Sure. And you know, I'm where I am in life, right? I'm in my 40s and I'm having the same kind of thoughts, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't need this pile of money for 10, 15, 20 years, right?
Yeah.
So like, what do I do with all that, right? So those are conversations I'm having with myself in my head.
Yeah.
But I hear you on that, on liquidity constraints. And I guess kind of pivoting a little bit, you know, when we talk about hedge funds and y'all use some hedge fund allocation, you said earlier.
Yeah.
You know, are you looking at the strategy, the manager, the talent? You know, what's driving those that make the sieve, make that 1% or 2% sieve?
Yeah.
What's really driving those choices?
When it comes to hedge funds,
yeah.
which is completely counter to when it comes to investing in ETFs. It's okay. all about talent.
Yep.
It's all about access to capital and being able to build the best teams, attract the most talented portfolio managers, the most talented analysts, and having access to the best technology. If you don't have that edge, because you got to remember, you know, there's a whole, and I went to University of Chicago.
Oh, so, it's fantastic.
Right. I mean, that's where efficient markets were born.
Oh, yes, they were.
And are markets really efficient? I mean, if you ask some of these managers that are active, they're the ones that make these markets efficient. Right, they're the ones who are doing that really deep dive due diligence on individual companies and saying, hey, there's a misalignment between price and valuation. And that could be because the company is undervalued and you go long those companies, or it could be that the companies are overvalued and you go short those companies. And you create a portfolio of these types of structures where you have as much long and short exposure. And what ultimately you're doing is you're no longer betting on which direction the market's going. You're pretty much betting on your ability to make the right decisions on which companies you're going long or short. And it doesn't have to be companies. It could be all different types of structures and securities domestically and global as well.
I love that answer. So you're, I mean, talent, relationships, ability to find arbitrage, systems, technology. And you know, it's, I can't just go in Morningstar and do a filter for that, can I?
You probably could, but you're going to get like a low quality mutual fund that anybody has access to.
So the research team at Vivaldi, you're looking into those factors?
Absolutely.
Do you go to their shops and look around? Like how does that work?
Yeah, we have annual onsites with every single manager that's on our platform.
Oh my gosh.
So we go there, we see, we're not just calling them and looking at a fact sheet. You know, we're really building relationships with each and every manager that's on our platform.
That's just so cool. I don't know why. I just enjoy that process.
Yeah.
And I think that's something too that, you know, there's a scale of a firm like Vivaldi, right? Like you've gone from that 150 million to a point where you've got two research departments, right? That have the capacity for this. And I think that's important to consider in the advisor space when somebody is looking at alts in a portfolio and client, you know, to look at systems and RIAs maybe that have that capability.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good point because it's not inexpensive to carry that cost because you have employee costs, you have a lot of travel, you have a lot of research due diligence cost. And what we've done over the past couple of years is we actually spun off our research team, and Vivaldi was really the cornerstone client of that research team. But we've gone out to other advisors because what's going on is, you know, as people like you are having these types of conversation alternatives, it's becoming more and more common.
Well, I think it is. Yeah, I absolutely think it is. I think you're seeing the world say, okay, I mean, in a nutshell, I think there's challenges to the advisor value proposition. I think there's challenges to the 1% AUM model. I think some of those challenges question...
I'd be curious to hear what your thoughts are, the challenges are.
Yeah, and I think those challenges question the 60-40 ETF portfolio. Right? I'm managing $2 million for a client. I've got them in a 60-40 portfolio. I'm going to build $20,000 a year on that.
Yeah.
What am I doing for that $20,000? I mean, initially, yes, there's some work up front and we have processes and we have fiduciaries. And of course, there's a liability we're taking by giving advice. But in the end, if I'm using ETFs, I'm using stocks and bonds, I think we're starting to see more questions around the advisor value proposition. And when you have advisors that can start pulling different alts and look at private equity and look at hedge funds and take a deep dive to kind of shift out, all right, well, you know, this one does their own in-house accounting and valuation, we're going to take a different direction.
Yeah.
Suddenly, as a consumer and as a client, I'm getting an additional value piece in that AUM proposition that maybe I wasn't getting in that traditional market. And of course, alts aren't going to be for everybody. Not every client or consumer is going to be comfortable. Heck, not all of them will be accredited, but the ones we're talking about are.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of one of the, I think that's a challenge to the advisor value proposition. I think it's been getting louder as technology's made things quicker.
I think so too. And it's forced a lot of advisors, RIAs to increase a lot of other services, tax planning, retirement planning. It'd be a lot more in touch with their clients versus I think back in the day, you could just put clients in a portfolio like that, charge 1% and maybe talk to them once a year. That doesn't work anymore. Those clients will leave.
I think the value add has to be there. I think the value add and being able to sort, filter and discriminate in the alt space is a huge value
for
add.
For certain types of clients, yeah.
For the right people.
For the right people.
But I would add that on. And you know, I also think to some extent, when we're looking at tech tools and, you know, speeding things up. And this is very Michael Kitsy's, right?
But oh, a lot of... I was listening to Michael on the way here.
Oh my gosh, genius. You know, I think so much about like what used to take a long time and used to take Excel spreadsheets and used to take some more complicated analysis, right? It's done in an instant now, right? So we got to think about how we add value. I think that's a very important part of the world.
Yeah.
Is that tech has sped that up to some extent.
It has. Oftentimes I say just making the very complex lives of our clients simpler. And that could be with alternatives or it could be with planning or just frankly, for some folks, just taking their hodgepodge mess of a balance sheet and just putting it into e-money and saying, this is what it really looks like.
Well, I think that's important. I'm gonna pivot just a minute kind of with a general question.
Sure.
When we talk about business owners, right? I think we have some even more unique tax elements in the alt space maybe because we have the ability to, you know, 1031 and defer gains and do some fun opportunity zone stuff, right? And when we get into that, is it a different alt calculation when we're looking at the tax end of it, or are we using, you know, DSTs? And how do you go about the business owner sale, deferral, real estate sales? How do you guys look at those things?
First of all, business owners are my favorite clients to work with.
Love it. Love it.
And those that have liquidity events, because they can pretty much give you a blank slate.
Yes.
Right? You're not dealing with pre-existing relationships. You're getting, you know, here you go. How do we allocate this? And yeah, we do. We've used qualified opportunity zones. We've got a few great providers in that space that are building primarily apartment buildings and growth markets in the South and Southeast region of the countries. DST, we work with a lot of real estate owners. Our 1031 DST program is fantastic. It's one of the biggest no-brainer solutions because we work with a lot of folks, as you can imagine. You got people in their 60s, 70s, 80s have built up nice real estate portfolios. It's been kind of their cash cow, but they get to a point where they're like, I don't want to deal with management. And they're the next generation, you see, they don't really want to take over that management of that property. So oftentimes without these solutions, they're stuck. They're like, I don't want to sell and pay this tax bill.
Yeah.
But we have the programs to be able to eventually get them into a private REIT. They get to maintain their cost basis, a step up cost basis when the money goes to their beneficiaries, 4-6% of tax efficient income. So we do that kind of stuff. You know, we look at exchange funds as an example for people that run concentrated, they have concentrated individual stocks that want to minimize their exposure to an Amazon or an Apple or an NVIDIA. Sure. So there's a lot of tools in our toolkit that we can use for business owners, real estate investors, really anybody.
What I think is interesting, I want to dig in a little bit on that, is, you know, a big challenge in our profession is the upcoming shift of wealth, generational wealth shift, right? And I like what you said there, right? Because you made a comment. You're like, the next generation doesn't necessarily want to deal with it, right? And so I hadn't really thought of looking at DSTs and other alt tax strategies as a way to preserve your next generation of client, but I guess I should.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of doing it, right? You're bringing them into the fold. Other interesting things we've done is donor advised funds and getting kids to participate in decision making of where money goes for charitable organizations.
Do you look at the broader platforms for those, or do you actually have some private offerings in that space, or you look at the big ones?
We use Schwab primarily,
okay,
because that's our, you know, we used to use TDs.
Sure. I mean that, yeah, but they're, yeah, that's they're no gone. Moss, right?
But we're able to use our for a big enough donor advised fund, we can use our private offerings in that space.
So I guess just maybe two or three more questions for you. I really appreciate your time today.
Take your time.
The first is, you know, we look at commercial real estate and we look at kind of, okay, COVID wasn't great for commercial real estate and interest rates aren't great for commercial real estate markets. Mm-hmm. What kind of products and tools do you have or use that, you know, in the commercial real estate space, you know, maybe help add diversification, right? Yeah. So we're not necessarily putting all the eggs in one basket. And how have y'all kind of worked around interest rates popping up and usage going down?
Yeah. And now when you say commercial real estate, are you talking about office or do you want to talk about all aspects of real estate?
Let's hit all aspects. Let's add to the listener here.
Okay, absolutely. So real estate, there's this old adage, location, location, location.
Yeah.
You could also say asset class, asset class, asset class. Because it's really a tale of multiple asset classes. Apartment buildings during COVID did absolutely phenomenal.
Oh, fantastic.
Right? Yeah. People, there's the big story right now, there's this huge undersupply of places to live.
Oh, yeah.
There's been a big rush to develop new single family homes and apartment buildings. That's part of the whole QOZ thing. So that space has done actually very well. Last year was a struggle, not so much because rent growth didn't continue to go up, but because a lot of these apartment buildings, their valuations are based on interest rates. And interest rates went from 0 to 6 or 7% last year for at least financing. So that put a big damper on prices. So apartment buildings did struggle, but the income continues to be solid. Industrial has done really well. We're not going away from people ordering online.
Right.
And you need those last mile fulfillment centers,
yes,
and warehouse centers. So that continues to, and it's hard to build those.
Oh,
it's hard to get the zoning right,
sure,
for those. So that's been interesting. We do have a lot of interesting stuff actually in retail. That's a space people have been very afraid of because they're like, well, Amazon is going to ruin all retail. Like brick and mortar retail.
Right.
And that's not the case.
No.
At the end of the day, your kids need to go to jiu-jitsu and you got to get your haircuts and people like to go out and get restaurants.
Yeah.
So we found really good opportunities, primarily in grocery anchored retail spaces.
Sure.
In the South, a lot in the South, Southwest region of the country. The area that's really, really struggled, and we're in a high rise right now, right?
Right.
We're in the middle of Chicago, is office. Now, a lot of these office leases, they could be 10, 20 years. So you're still seeing a lot of people pay. But sooner or later, those are going to roll off. And are we going to go back to full office for most people? It's hard for most organizations. Probably more hybrid. So people are going to need less office. So a lot of these offices are going to struggle and have started struggling. That's the biggest issue I think you see in real estate is office.
That is fantastic. That's just a great, succinct answer.
Yeah.
We'll be leveraging that answer on a lot of platforms. So thank you for
that. Absolutely.
That was great. So we always ask every guest on Land Everything Else a closing question. And that question is, if you're giving advice to a young financial planner or new financial advisor, and you're going to give any advice about working with clients in the alt space, what advice do you give that person?
Well, first of all, being in the investment advisory business is a fantastic career. So if this is the place where you want to be, you have lots of opportunity. And if you're thinking specifically about alternatives, I think it's all about just as doing as much research and understanding the landscape as possible. So continuously reading, whether it's Barron's or listening to Kitsis, or our research team puts out continuous notes, but you can always find that stuff out there too. Getting your Kaya, getting your CFA. I think it's just a lifelong journey of really trying to learn and seeing what's out there. And once you understand that, you can communicate that to other people.
Well, I absolutely love that answer. And thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Land and Everything Else. For more information on alternative investing, find us on your favorite social media platform using the links in our show notes. Thank you to the production team behind the podcast, PodPony. If you're ready to up your podcast game, visit podpony.com to saddle up and learn more. I'm Dr. Craig Lemoyne. You can find me at Higher Ed Craig, and this is the Land and Everything Else podcast. We'll see you again real soon.